Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to emforum.org. I am Amy Sebring, and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. We are using our new webinar platform today for the first time, and we'll be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to take part in this discussion, and we hope it goes smoothly. Bear with us if we have a few hiccups. If you need assistance, please select Help Desk from the drop-down options in the chat panel, and our associate, Lori Weber, will try to assist you. We do hope that you will find today's topic to be very helpful to you in preventing common and costly mistakes under a disaster declaration for public assistance resulting from failing to closely follow all applicable regulations. First, for the benefit of any first-timers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed with your questions or comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program. You may wish to jot down any questions you have as we go along. All right. Today's recordings, hopefully, and a copy of the slides will be available from our site later this afternoon, and a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce Michael Martinet, CEM, and principal of the Martinet Group, LLC, specializing in disaster finance training and cost recovery planning. Previously served as emergency planning manager with the controller's office in the city and county of San Francisco, and he also served for 16 years as the executive director for the Office of Disaster Management Area G, a consortium of 14 cities in Los Angeles County. Please see today's background page for further biographical details and links to related resources. Welcome back, Mike, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Thank you, Amy, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for all joining us. Delighted to be here again. So I start out with this spaceman picture. I suppose many of you saw the movie Gravity. I'm told by people who get the experience of working in a federal disaster for the first time, it's not unlike this experience. You're just kind of free-floating and don't know where gravity and where the ground is. Myself, 25 years as an emergency manager. I have a master's degree in emergency services administration, a certified emergency manager. And I think more significantly, I've been teaching finance administration cost recovery for over 15 years. I've done 40 classes, primarily in California, but other states as well. Well over 1,000 students have been with me through these classes. I'm preaching to the choir here, but as you can see, this annual disaster loss chart from Munich Re, which is an international reinsurance company that tracks natural disasters globally, worldwide. And what's significant about this line that I just added is that's the insured losses halfway up. And if you can see the color, which is not great, but you can see the difference, that's typical for these catastrophic disasters. Only half of the losses are insured. Fortunately, in this country, we do have Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Stafford Act to provide us additional financial resources, and it becomes critical when only half your losses are insured. My work is largely based on audits. I've got a collection of 250 audits. Gives you an idea what a fabulous social life I have. But I read these audits because this is where the rubber meets the road. You can actually see where people are making mistakes and losing money, and what are the specific fixes they need to implement changes to avoid these kind of findings in the future. This is how federal government people see our poorly managed project worksheets. And this is what they want to see. Okay, we've got to stay within the lines. We've got to use appropriate information because this is how the auditors see those same files, strictly black and white. Years after the emotion and the drama of a disaster is over, the auditors come in, and to them, it's just you followed the rules or you did not. And their findings sometimes run into the tens of millions of dollars. So in my review of audits, and I've done an analysis of these 250 audits, these are the top five audit problems that the auditors cite by count, by numeric count. Number one is purchasing, and we're going to get into that in a minute. Second one is lack of proper documentation. Third is ineligible work. Fourth is insurance. And fifth is project management. And we're going to go through those here, but spend most of our time on purchasing. But first, I want to give you some examples. So this is a high school in the Midwest. They had a couple of issues cited in the audit. One was the repair versus replace, and the other was insurance. But on purchasing, they lost $1.36 million on purchasing alone. This is a city in the West Coast. They lost $16 million on an audit. This is a county in the Northeast United States. The auditors hit them for $39 million in purchasing alone. The total findings were for $48 million. Purchasing alone was $39 million. Now, I will tell you on this particular case, the United States Senator from that state got involved and somehow FEMA revised the finding and decided they only owed $705,000, but that was a rather extraordinary case in that reversal. This is a university down in the southern part of the United States. In August, they got hit for $46 million, every penny purchasing related. Every penny, $46 million purchasing related. This is a university in the Midwest. This was a repair-replace situation. The OIG, Office of Inspector General, had a finding of almost $84 million they want back from this university on this particular case. So you can see some of these cases really run into some serious money. Now, where are we spending public assistance dollars? My experience is most people want to track their fire, their law, their public works, those emergency response activities. But this data comes from the FEMA website itself. This is for fiscal years 2011-2012. I checked a few weeks ago. The 13 data is not yet available. This is where the feds say they're spending money. So first of all, you've got water control facilities, which is less than 2%. Then you have state management, which is very small, less than 3%. We're not going to concern ourselves with that. This is recreation or other, just over 3%. This is Cat A, debris removal. Now, I'm waiting for the 13 numbers because that's going to include Sandy, and I think we're going to see a big jump in those numbers for debris removal. Those previous 2 years were kind of low. Then you got Cat F, public utilities. Then we have Cat B, protective measures. This is the law, the fire, the sheltering, the sandbagging, the flood fight. We're going to come back to that. I put that in red for a very specific reason, so I want to talk about that a little bit more in a second. Then we have public buildings, okay, repair and replace. And then finally we have roads and bridges, which is over 25%. But when we total these numbers up, this Cat B is still less than 20% of all the federal money the feds distribute. But in my experience, that's where most people focus their cost recovery efforts, is tracking those emergency numbers, and yet it's less than 20%. So what that means, when we take away the state management, is 79% of the money that cities and counties are spending goes function. Almost 80% goes through the purchasing function. And yet, purchasing people often are not a part of the emergency planning spectrum. Now, when we talk about disaster purchasing, this is the kind of thing we have. Emergency supplies, food, water, ice, generators, fuel, those kinds of things that we need for the crisis. But when we're doing disaster purchasing, we have to follow our rules, and we must follow the federal rules. And there's two sets of federal rules. One is Title 44, Section 1336, the Code of Federal Regulations. The second one is Title 2 of the Code of Federal Regulations. Now, you've got Sections 215, 220, 225, and 230. For local governments, we only follow the 215. If you're a college, university, if you're a nonprofit, or the other one's escaping me, we only follow one of those four. They're almost identical. And if you're following Title 44, 1336, you're probably picking up all of the requirements in these other four sections. They're a little bit duplicative. Now, why am I telling you this? This is purchasing. This is not emergency management. Because my observation is that most emergency managers are not aware of this information. I've talked to dozens of people at conferences, and this is a big revelation to them. And purchasing people don't know it either. That's the key. Nobody really is aware of this except Homeland Security auditors. Now, let's talk about the purchasing function for a minute. On our day-to-day purchasing, we have to follow our rules, and we have to follow our rules for buying all of these different components on a day-to-day basis, regular purchasing. But in a disaster, we've got a dual pathway. In that crisis phase, we have exigent circumstances, life and death kind of situations. When we make purchases without going through our processes, they must address life safety, a threat to public health, or improved property. We have about a 70-hour window when we've got leeway that the feds allow us. It's a good idea, though, to support those with sole source documentation, a page or two document that shows why we bought this stuff without going through our processes, that it was necessary to address an issue of life safety, threat to public health, or improved property. Beyond that, we have disaster-related non-emergency purchases that must comply with 44 CFR. Now, let me repeat that. Disaster-related but non-emergency purchases, and I'll explain that concept in a minute. But you see, those must comply with 44 CFR and our day-to-day purchasing rules. Now, for those sole source things, we can rent equipment, materials and supplies, debris management for 70 hours, emergency services, but again, they have to be in this criteria of exigent circumstances. Once we get past that first phase, those first few days, we then have to start complying with 44 CFR for all of these purchases. The fact that we have a locally or even a gubernatorially proclaimed disaster does not give us an exemption from following the federal rules. No exemption whatsoever. In my analysis, I went through and did a search for every occurrence of 1336. And these are what I call the dirty dozen, the most commonly cited findings in audits. Cost-price analysis. So in 250 audits, there were 390 findings, and almost 20% were related to cost-price analysis. Unreasonable requirements. That includes geographic preferences. Many agencies will give a local vendor a slight preference in purchasing, and that violates federal codes. fail to maintain procurement records, they do sole source purchases beyond that eligible window, and so on. You can read these. They will be available. But these are the most common findings for purchasing violations. So the number one takeaway this morning is, does my agency's purchasing system meet federal requirements? Now, I'm working with a client in the San Francisco Bay Area with 16 agencies. I've looked at the purchasing policies for four of those agencies, and all four of those agencies in one way or another violate some section of this Title 44, Section 1336. So it's fairly common, and if you look at the audits, you see why. So the second most common failing is lack of supporting documentation. This includes having all of your purchasing documentation in your file. That includes bid announcements, all the bids, winning and losing, and all the contractor documents. So we have that 3-year retention period for documents. The contractors we use on these jobs also have to retain their records for 3 years past that close of the file. So what we need then is we need a plan. Do we have a separate, standalone disaster cost recovery plan? I've seen all kinds of emergency plans. I've not yet seen a good, current, complete plan for disaster cost recovery. The disaster itself may last a few days, a couple of weeks. The cost recovery process goes on for years, sometimes decades. Fire law, even public works, gets frequent, oftentimes intense training. Finance, purchasing, administrative people almost never get training, and yet their part of the disaster goes on for years and sometimes decades. So I think we've got to refocus our training efforts and realization of where the real costs of disasters lie. So takeaway number two, do we really understand the breadth and depth of the documentation requirements? Third most common, ineligible work. 3 out of 10 failed on this score. I've got two clients working on a presidentially declared disaster right now. One of them is extremely interesting because what was destroyed was a summer camp that the agency owned in the mountains. The community goes up there every summer and, you know, camps out. But the entire camp is on federally owned land. It's owned by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And so it's going to have some real interesting implications. One of the things they want them to do, the USDA, is to cut down about 1,400 trees. But those trees are federal property, and they sit on federal land. I'm not sure we're going to be able to get reimbursed for that work, because if it's the domain of another federal agency, it's not eligible. And you can look at hundreds of cases where the auditor's site and FEMA often denies eligibility because we don't understand going in what the rules are. Eligibility also includes the fact that it has to be in the disaster area caused by the disaster, the legal responsibility of the agency, and this is a big deal, this legal responsibility. In an analysis with one of my clients, we looked at how many of the agencies lease a building to or from another government agency, lease a building to a private for-profit or a private nonprofit. Because depending on how the lease terms are structured, they may have written themselves out of responsibility to be eligible to get reimbursed for disaster damage. And that's one of the issues we're going to address. How do we make sure that we are the eligible applicant and that we haven't contracted that away to somebody who, in fact, isn't eligible? Eligibility. This is another issue that's coming up. People have facilities they're not fully using. And when you don't fully use a facility, that portion of the facility is not eligible for federal reimbursement. So the city of Atascadero here in California lost $2.7 million on an eligibility issue because a building that they reported as being 100% used, in fact, was just a little over 80% used. And when the auditors came back and did the calculations, it cost them $2.7 million for that empty space. Ineligible work also includes lack of maintenance, deferred maintenance. It includes work where you don't have a maintenance plan. So I know of an agency not far from us here in Southern California, heavy damage to their roof systems, but they did not have a regular roof inspection, and they didn't have a roof maintenance program. And so FEMA denied eligibility for those damaged roofs. Now, that doesn't mean, however, that ineligible expenses are lost forever, because we can capture that. And probably the flagship example of this right now is Joplin, Missouri. After the tornado that ripped through there in May of 2011, they did a fabulous job of tracking all of the disaster volunteer hours and the in-kind donations. They got a credit against their local cost share of $17.7 million. $17.7 million they recovered, not as a payment from FEMA, but as money they did not have to pay to the federal government for the local cost share. So this is a shining example of when you've got a disaster cost recovery plan and they include your volunteer component, it can be worth a substantial amount of money to the local agency when it's properly handled. So takeaway number three, we need to understand eligibility requirements. This will help us avoid huge surprises later. Now, the next one is insurance failure. Findings relative to insurance of a variety of different cases. The feds look at insurance. It's one of the special considerations that's written into every single project worksheet. They want to know if we have insurance, how much is covered, what's covered. They can deduct from the obligation of the project worksheet the actual or the anticipated insurance proceeds. So if you've got a $10 million policy on a $10 million building, they may owe you nothing but the deductible if they choose to interpret it that way. Or they may wait and say, well, let's see what the insurance people are going to pay, and then we'll give you the balance. Sometimes it doesn't go that way. After a disaster, applicants are required to obtain and maintain insurance coverage on all insurable facilities. This is huge in that portion of the country where they have flood insurance available. If you don't buy flood insurance after you get federally funded for disaster repair and reconstruction, I can show you several audits where the auditors come back and said, you didn't buy the insurance, you didn't maintain the insurance, and therefore we want $12 million back. In one case, in a southern city, they wanted $62 million back because the agency failed to purchase insurance. That's a serious hit, and it's also a very nasty headline if you happen to be the emergency manager or the finance director. We also have to know what's covered under our policy. What are the deductibles? Do we have before pictures so that we can clearly demonstrate to FEMA this is the quality of the facilities we had, judged by these before photos, and now here's the after photos. So pre-disaster photo documentation is really important. It can be a huge tool in getting the maximum federal reimbursements. Here's another little issue. So school district in Louisiana hit Hurricane Rita. They had 500 buildings. Their policy said they had a $10,000 per facility deductible. So 10,000 times 500 is $5 million. Had the language read, we have a $10,000 per occurrence. So Rita was the occurrence. Their deductible would have been only $10,000 instead of $5 million. So integrating our risk management people into our disaster cost recovery program is extremely important, because one out of four audits has insurance-related findings. And then, of course, we have to ask ourselves, where are we protecting and how are we protecting our agency assets? Where are our insurance policies? When were they last reviewed? Where do we keep them? The first time I took a class in cost recovery, it was taught by a gentleman who had been the state director for South Carolina, and they had a small city where the city hall was blown right off its foundations in a hurricane. And the feds were kind of abrupt and said, you know, folks, we just don't think you had this nice a city hall. Why don't you show us the plans? Well, the question is, where do you store the plans for City Hall? Typically in City Hall. So the question is, do we have our important documentation backed up and backed up off-site, someplace where it's out of the hazard zone for whatever we're dealing with? Another issue that we have to look at is when we're doing debris clearance from the public right-of-way following a disaster, the agency has to go back to the homeowner and make an inquiry, did you have debris removal insurance? It's common in policies. And if they did have the insurance, then we have to go against the insurance company, or the homeowner has to go against the insurance company and get that money back to the local agency, and it has to be sent back to FEMA. Otherwise, they're going to deduct that amount of money. And the experience they have is that one out of every so many homes has it, and they'll make an automatic deduction. So we have to make a good faith effort to cost recover insurance for debris removal. Another thing we can do to protect ourselves is determine in advance who our insurance adjuster is going to be. A hospital in the San Diego area did this before they were hit by a wildfire some years ago. The hospital and the insurance company agreed on an individual who would be the adjuster. They both agreed they would honor the adjuster's findings, and it sped up the process, and nobody had a bad taste that they got taken in by the other side. So it's one of those little things that we can do up front for our own agency facilities, is know who's going to be our insurance adjuster. So we have insurance nightmares. It may take a long time. One of my clients in the Bay Area is telling me it may take insurance a year to settle. That means they're going to be in limbo in terms of actual cost recovery for at least a year while the insurance is settling out. Now, one of the ways that we can speed up this process is to consider using a public adjusting firm to back for our team, because the insurance people are in business. They're going to look to shave and cut corners everywhere they can. And a public adjuster is somebody who works for us. They're paid by us, and they can help maximize our insurance cost recovery. So, takeaway number four, we want to make risk management a part of our disaster cost recovery plan. Is our risk manager even aware? In one survey I did of communities, two-thirds of the communities didn't even have a full-time risk manager. And yet, when you're looking at millions or tens of millions of dollars in potential federal disaster assistance, all of a sudden risk management becomes a very significant player in the entire process. The last of the top five is project management and accounting failures. People simply don't have systems in place. this is how the auditor sees our files when we don't have good project accounting. It's just simply a mass documents that we can't solve this puzzle. We get no information. We got no colors. There's no way to determine what's right and what's wrong. And when the auditors can't determine that, the findings always go against the local agency. So we have to have definition and good information in our project management system. Words are everything. We can write projects. We can explain damages in ways that are eligible, and we can also explain them in ways that are ineligible. How things are written is absolutely critical. Let me give you one example. You have a library. It's hit by an earthquake. All the books are off the shelves. If the librarians come in and put the shelves back on, the books back on the shelves, that's librarians' work. That is not eligible. But if you have people from Public Works come in and simply pick the books up and put them on the shelves in no particular order, that can be described as debris clearance, and that can be eligible. Better yet, have volunteers come in or contract outside workers come in and pick those books up and clear the debris, and it now is eligible in one way or another, as opposed to having your librarians do it. Yes, the librarians are going to have to go back and put them in order, but part of that work can be eligible. And there are lots of different things like that. How we describe it can set off alarms to FEMA and to the auditors, or if we write it properly and give it full definition, it's not even going to raise an eyebrow. So takeaway number five, are we integrating project management and accounting into the disaster cost recovery plan? In a survey I recently did with clients, we found that virtually none of them had a system in place for managing the whole public works, project worksheet grant process. So disaster cost recovery is a team sport. We can't do it alone. We need our risk management. We need our purchasing people. I'm finding that we're going to be having some discussions with city attorneys and county councils on issues of leasing property to private, for-profit, non-profit, and other government agencies, other policies, disaster feeding for employees, disaster lodging for employees. We need to integrate the attorneys. So there's lots of people outside of the emergency people. Frankly, I often don't care whether fire and law are at the table in terms of cost recovery. My experience is that they're not going to be involved in this years and decades later. It's the back office people. It's the business people within city government. And disaster cost recovery is all about good communications with all parties involved. We have to be talking to all the departments that sustained loss. We have to talk to our insurance carriers. We have to talk to, obviously, to the state and to FEMA. And also we need to talk to other agencies that were hit in a disaster. Just had an experience with this. The two clients I have in the Bay Area, FEMA was asking client A about the building codes involved for work with client B. They're two separate cities down different sides of the San Francisco Bay, and yet that one city ought to know that FEMA is making inquiries about its building codes, and you will never know that unless you're talking and communicating with them on a regular basis. That's my presentation. I want to thank you all once again. And I'm going to do a short non-commercial advertisement. The International Association of Emergency Managers just started up a disaster cost recovery ad hoc committee. It's just forming up. We've got about 38 members who've expressed interest. If you would like to on this committee or be on the mailing list, please send an email to me at that address, and just in the subject line, put Disaster Cost Recovery Committee. Disaster Cost Recovery Committee. I will add you to the list and make you a part of the emails that I send out. So, Amy, that's the presentation. I'm going to turn it back to you and any questions that you might get.
Thank you very much, Mike. You've certainly given us a few things to think about. Some of them are not so obvious. Hopefully, folks won't have to learn the hard way, which I'm sure many, many have in the past. Okay, to ask a question or make a comment, just type into the chat panel. I have to change it here so I get the questions. Okay, and then you click on send, and then I'll read the questions or comments aloud, and our guest will respond via the audio. Please keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. We are ready to begin now, so please enter your comment or question at any time. And if you happen to have put a question in the chat before, I've probably lost it, so if you could re-enter that question, we would appreciate it. I'm sorry, Mike, did you mention a spreadsheet?
I did not. Thanks for bringing that up, Amy. So for Title 44, Section 1336, that section of the federal code has almost 100 points of compliance, things that we're required to do or in some cases not do, to comply with federal regulations. If you send me an email, again, at that address, I will send you an Excel spreadsheet that contains every point of compliance within that section of code, and you can work your way through it. It's fairly simple to use. Basically, the questions that are in there all want to be answered yes. If you answer yes to all of them, you'll be 100% compliant. To the extent you answer no or unknown, it will give you a numeric compliance score. It is not a FEMA document. It is not in any way, shape, or form federally approved, but it is a detailed analysis of this code section. It will certainly give you a guidepost by which you can measure your own purchasing policy. Just started to distribute it. If you get it and use it, I would love to get your comments back on it. So just put in there 44 CFR 1336 worksheet or spreadsheet, and I will send that to you.
Very good. That sounds like a very useful checklist. Okay, I have a question from Dan Linehan. He says, at what point does the 70-hour rule start, and who declares the start?
My understanding is, and that question came up recently in a FEMA briefing, is the local agency determines when that 70-hour period starts, because depending on the kind of disaster you have, if you have a tornado, it's a sudden start, and maybe you can't mobilize for 6 or 8 hours. So why penalize yourself 6 or 8 hours of that valuable time? So the local agency can declare that start period. Now, that said, that's what they're telling us in Region 9. There are 10 FEMA regions, and they all interpret things differently sometimes. So check with your local FEMA representative. But that's what we were recently told in a FEMA briefing, is the local agency can determine the start time. Check it, okay? Because if there's anything about public assistance, it's that it's variable across the country. Good question, though.
Okay, I have a question from Paul John, who says, and I hope you can understand his question. He says, do we recommend using And IMAT, I assume it means an incident management assistance team, and if so, what type and specialist?
I believe you would, and it's going to depend a lot on the kind of disaster you have. What kind of an IMAT team you use, or if you use one, shouldn't have a huge impact on your overall cost recovery, because they're going to be in there for typically such a very short time relative to the entire cost recovery process. And by the way, I don't know if there are any cost recovery IMAT teams. And that's one of the things I'm hoping may come out of this Disaster Cost Recovery Committee that the IAEM has just started, is maybe we can pull together a cost recovery IMAT team. But I'm not aware that one exists anywhere in the country.
Sounds like a good idea.
Excellent idea. I know some people that would like to have one.
Okay, I have a question from Isabel McCurdy, and she says, "Hi, Mike, where does one find a public adjuster?"
The Yellow Pages. Well, young people don't know what the Yellow Pages are hardly anymore. Search them on Yahoo. If you call me offline, I can give you the name of one company I know. They're national. I'm not here to pitch anybody, but talk to your insurance agency. Probably is not going to want to share this information with you because they're the opponent, okay? But yeah, Yellow Pages, Google, or give me a call offline or send me an email. But in one case, I recently talked with one relative to one of my clients, and he said their typical experience is that they can save sometimes upwards of get the client up to 70% more money from insurance settlements than they would have gotten from their own insurance company. So to me, it's like if I've got to have brain surgery, I want a real specialist, and I want somebody on my side.
I have a comment from William Warren who says, "Today's emergency manager should know as much about cost recovery." Oops, this is changing as speak. Cost recovery as everything else, such as response, mitigation, et cetera. I guess that says a lot about how the field has advanced over the years. Seems like we have to know everything about everything.
yes. And that's what I'm trying to do is make people more aware that the cost recovery is huge. If I could get all the rest of the money, I wouldn't care about the police and fire emergency money, because then I'd get 80%, which is way above the national average for cost recovery.
A question from Carolyn Harshman, who says, "Who do you recommend, quote, lead the charge on developing a cost recovery plan? Seems like it should be risk management or finance, since the emergency manager is so far removed from the daily processes."
That is a good question, because this really is an emerging area to me. Most emergency managers, in my experience, don't have the breadth and depth of knowledge of cost recovery, but finance and risk management people, by and large, in my experience, do not have this knowledge either. So it's kind of a bootstrap. And I will say that I try to get to conferences and talk about this subject often. And when I get a chance, I seem to grab people's attention pretty good. So I think it has to be raised, but I'm finding that the more I can pitch this to finance directors and financial people, it seems to get much better traction than if I talk to the fire chief or the police chief about it, or even the city manager. The finance people seem to grasp this much more. And I'm finding that the audit tools are really effective, because this is real life, and no finance director wants to have a multi-million dollar audit finding against their agency.
And you did make the point about putting a team together, right?
Absolutely. Yes. In fact, that's one of the things we're doing with one of my clients in the Bay Area, is we're going to be integrating emergency management, finance directors, risk management, public works, and other business people, office people. Fire and law will play a secondary role in the whole cost recovery thing. They're not the real driving business people. It's the finance and finance related people, purchasing, especially within a city or county.
I have a question about recording and slides, which I was going to reiterate at the end, but we will have a recording posted this afternoon and the slides. You'll be able to download them from our homepage later this afternoon, assuming everything goes well with our recording. Okay, I do have a question from Andrew Berglund, who says, can you expound on the difference between using volunteers and contractors in relation to cost recovery? I think you mentioned that, in the context of debris removal, perhaps?
Right. So if you're using contractors on disaster-related work, the cost of that contract, assuming that the work is eligible, the cost of that contract is reimbursable by the federal government. Typically it's 75%, but if you get into a really big event like Katrina or Sandy, it can go up to 90%, theoretically higher. So you spend the money on a contract, and then you will get reimbursed when you put your documentation in. For the volunteers, you cannot get reimbursed. But I use the example of a copay when I go to the doctor. So if I go to the doctor, I have to pay $20 copay. That's my share of the doctor visit. The value of volunteers' time, and in Joplin, I think they had 100,000 volunteers, something on that order, and I think they had 600,000 documented hours of volunteer time. And they valued that time at just under $15 an hour. So that alone was like $9 million. And that was what they could apply toward their, if you will, their copay to the federal government. So if I had, let's say, a $75 prescription in my hand when I went into the doctor's office and I showed it to them, and they'd say, oh, you already paid $75 for medical care, therefore you don't owe us the copay today. And so the one is reimbursable, contract's reimbursable. You have to spend the money. The volunteers, they never get paid in the first place, but you can value what you would have paid them and use that to offset the share you would have to pay to the federal government.
Kind of like an in-kind bonus contribution.
Yes.
Okay, a question from William Warren, who asks, would the cost of a public adjuster be considered a recoverable expenditure?
My understanding is that it may be. I'm told by a public adjuster, people I know, that in Sandy, they're getting, the agency's getting reimbursed for those expenses. And it makes good sense in this way, because the more money the agency recovers from the insurance carrier, the less money FEMA has to put out. And therefore, to me, it makes sense that it's a recoverable expenditure, because ultimately it helps reduce the cost to FEMA. But again, we got to go and see which one of the 10 regions we are in the United States to see whether they agree with that logic. One of the things that I say when I do a training class is that anything I say today could be wrong tomorrow, because as we all know, the regulations change and the interpretations of those regulations change.
Speaking of changes, there was one thing I was going to ask you about, and it's related, but if you don't know, then that's fine. I understand FEMA is doing a new pilot to simplify the public assistance procedures. Do you have any information about that?
Yes, I've read the regulations pretty carefully, and I don't think it's simplification in one way, but it doesn't reduce the complexity of the process, if that makes any sense. Most of the rules that were in place in terms of process, the kinds of information we have to have, the definition of scope of damage, the scope of work, all the paperwork still has to be done. So it's not simplified in that manner. How it is simplified a little bit is we now have these alternate procedures that will allow us flexibility in what we rebuild and how we rebuild or repair. Okay, so I think simplification is probably not the most appropriate word to use. It gives us some alternate pathways, but those alternate pathways for repair and reconstruction do come at a potential cost. So they have to be analyzed very carefully, in my opinion, whether somebody's going to use these new alternate procedures or not.
Does it get you your money any faster?
It can.
Yep.
It can. But the question is, at what cost? Because once you commit under these new alternate procedures, once you commit to that, you're fixed. So if you get a $1 million repair job, and it ends up costing you $1.3 million, you're stuck with $1 million. They will not allow you any additional money. So if you get your money 6 months early, it costs you $300,000 to get that money early. So each case, I believe, has to be carefully weighed as to how sure you are of the estimate and how sure you are there are going to be no unforeseen circumstances. And, of course, that's why they call them unforeseen circumstances, because you can't see them coming.
Okay, well, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up for today. On behalf of Ava Jean and myself and all our participants, thank you very much, Mike, again, for being with us and sharing this really excellent information.
My pleasure. Thank you all for joining us.
Folks, before you, to our audience, thank you very much for the very good questions today. And I do apologize for a few technical difficulties. I think we'll have it a little more streamlined next time. If you do have problems and can fill out this feedback form and include your contact information, then maybe I can try to troubleshoot you offline. Please do click on this link. It should open our feedback form in another window. And please do note that window may actually open behind your webinar window, so don't click it 12 times. Now, in particular, if you attended today to earn CEU credit, we've changed our procedure a little bit on that. You will need to fill out the feedback form. There's a new box to check, and we do need your name and email address near the bottom. Now, our next program will be March 19th, and our topic will be the National Weather Service's Tsunami Program. And our guest will be Rocky Lopes, now serving as Deputy Program Manager for Stakeholder Engagement. Until then, thanks to everyone for participating today, and have a great afternoon. And if you're on the East Coast, stay warm, stay safe. We feel for you. We are adjourned. Thanks, everybody. Bye.